Hi, this is Mark, and welcome to episode 26 of Nerdology, sponsored by CSO The Cult Fanzine. And my special guests today are Deb Stanish and Eric Stadnick. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Eric, you sound really full of beans.
Yes, I am full of beans. hi, Mark. It's great to be back.
Have we got Eric bot now?
15th time? Is that what? This is my 15th guest appearance, I think?
Well, you can't have too much of a good thing, can you, Eric?
Or me either, apparently. But I'm very glad you asked me back.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And we have the wonderful Deb Stanish.
Well, hello there. This is I feel like I'm piggybacking on Eric's coattails here because he's, you know, he's the permanent guest, sort of permanent guest status.
But. Well, that's how I get listeners to my podcast. I just get someone good in and it tends to bump the figures up a bit.
So
that's what I'm hoping.
The Eric Stanish spike.
Yeah, exactly. It works a treat. Now, Deb, for the uninitiated, is the co-editor of the Hugo-nominated Chicks Unravel Time. Mm-hmm. Weren't you involved in Chicks Dig Time Lords as well?
Yeah, I contributed an essay to Chicks Dig Time Lords, and then I went on with Lynn Thomas, who co-edited that anthology, to do Whedonistas, which is sort of a similar book in the world of Joss Whedon properties. And I've contributed to all sorts of things, Outside In, the first Outside In, and the Time Unincorporated series as well, and I just recently did an essay for Apex Magazine. So, yeah, there's little bits of me sprinkled throughout anthologies in Doctor Whoville.
And Eric, you've recently been involved in Queers Dig Time Lords.
Yeah, that was prompted by Deb. I suggested the idea for Queers Dig Time Lords to the publisher who had done Chicks Dig Time Lords and Chicks Unravel Time and Whedonistas, and thought it would be a good next step, and then wrote an essay for that. And apparently have an upcoming essay coming in February in Outside In 2, and I think I wrote something else, but I honestly can't remember at this point.
So keep your eyes peeled when you book shows.
I might be published somewhere in something about some stuff.
Excellent. Nice and vague. That's the way we like it. So the reason we got you two together, I mean, you two are good friends in real life.
I can't stand her.
I've heard that rumor. I didn't like to mention it.
Still have a bottle of your red licorice vodka in my car. So
How did you end up? Oh, fuck.
Nobody wanted it. We were in a con last weekend. We were in a con, and I was the only person that didn't fly. So they were like, "You have to take this stuff home." And I still don't quite know what to do with it.
You ended up with all the booze.
It wasn't that much left, actually. But what can I say?
Was this the Long Island 2 con?
Yes, which was last weekend. Well, last weekend
you guys were all over that, weren't you?
Yeah, we were. There was a bunch of us there. Chip from 2 Minute Time Lord was there, and we had Graham Burke and Robert Smith, and it was a really good time for a first year con. It was remarkably hitch-free, I would say. I'm sure that things didn't run perfectly, but they really did a nice job in sort of addressing the needs of the diverse group of people that were going to be there, lots of panel diversity, and really being adaptable to things as they were changing, which I always admire. Everybody who goes to a con thinks they can do it better, but you really don't know until you've run a con, and I think they did a nice job.
Friends of mine organized one earlier this year, and it's a hell of a lot of work. And I think they only really realized how much work it was partway through setting it up. And they did an incredible job. But people keep asking them, are you going to have the same thing next year? And they're thinking, maybe we need a year off just to get over the previous one. But I'm sure they'll do something again.
Yeah.
So you two... Unless I'm mistaken, I've not heard you both together on the same podcast. So I thought that would be a nice little dynamic to have.
We've never been on a podcast together, have we, Eric?
That's a vicious lie. Other than your very first podcast appearance ever, which was when I was still co-hosting Bridging the Rift.
Oh, Bridging the
Rift.
And
you came on to promote Chicks Dig Time Lords, and it was your very first podcast appearance ever.
That was. I had forgotten about that because I wasn't supposed to do that podcast.
No.
And Lynn and I were working on Whedonistas at the time, and Tara O'Shea, who was her co-editor couldn't make it, and she like emailed me and said, are you available in 15 minutes? I'm doing a podcast. And I was like, okay. And I think I actually like talked into my computer, like there was no mics.
The sound quality was significantly lower than
that. No idea what I was doing. So yes. And then I read for you once for Doctor Who Book Club.
Yes.
So,
yes.
But that was just sending an audio file. So we've actually sort of appeared twice together.
Hmm.
But
okay.
Since you've become a podcaster, this is the first actual together.
Yes.
Now, I asked you guys what you'd like to come on and talk about, and you came back with Agatha Christie.
Yes, we did.
And what prompted you to come up with that? Why is there a big passion for you both?
Well, I think actually I was emailing Eric about this and like, well, what can we talk to that we both have in common or things that we really like? And we kind of narrowed it down, I think, to Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Agatha Christie. Because while there are things that we like, I think our nerd buckets tend to run fairly differently and fairly shallowly when it comes to, you know, some more genre properties. At least that was sort of my take on it. And I knew this was something that he, because we had a conversation at one point where we were talking about comfort reading. And I remember him saying that Agatha Christie was sort of his go-to comfort reading. And it seemed like a fun idea because I had gone through a very passionate Agatha Christie phase in my life. And I thought it would be kind of fun to revisit that. So what was your sort of impetus in going with that choice, Eric?
Me? I don't know. I think I wanted to come on Mark's show with something I didn't have to prepare as much for.
Oops.
Actually, no. Given the amount of time spent preparing for the other things, reading, knocking out the four novels, which I only made it through 3 3/4, but still, was so much less work because I know the stories already. You know, everything is sort of familiar. It's not, they're not difficult books. They are comfort reading. And so plopping down of an evening, it's, you know, and doing 200 pages of an Agatha Christie when you have nothing else to do that night is not difficult. Doing that with Dickens was a challenge.
I have to confess, I cheated somewhat in as much as as I've mentioned on many occasions, my attention span is not great. And I have quite a big collection of audiobooks. So as well as having the sort of fun of revisiting Agatha Christie novels, I got to have them read to me by acclaimed actors who've been in roles in Christie novels. So that was quite a nice way of experiencing them. So we had Joan Hickson reading the Marple story, which I think she's brilliant.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, that's not a hardship there. I think that's actually...
No.
Yeah. And I tend to find, because I'm a very quick reader, that when I'm listening to an audiobook, I pick up so many more nuances of the story because it forces you to slow down and really focus, where I tend to, my eyes jumping to the end of the page to find out what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I have come to appreciate audiobooks a little bit more, not just as something I can do while I'm doing something else, but sometimes it really makes me concentrate and pick up the details that I may have missed if I'm not giving something a close reading and just sort of reading it for pleasure.
No, that's true.
So we picked a few variations because Agatha Christie had her kind of stable of recurring characters. So probably most notable, the two most notable would be Poirot and Miss Marple. But we also have the characters of Tommy and Tuppence and also the mysterious Mr. Quinn as well. So we came up with a short list of sort of picks to represent those characters.
Yeah, Eric actually selected the four books, the four representative books. I'm really curious because I didn't
select. you advised.
You just threw them all up in the air.
Well, we had talked about what, you know, sort of seminal characters we should discuss and where we wanted to go, and these were your selections. And I'm kind of curious as to why you picked these particular novels, because I think you had obviously the Harley Quinn was sort of easy because there's not that many of them.
Yeah, and I firmly believe that the Mr. Quinn stories are an interesting aspect of her writing that most people who think of Christie don't think of the mysterious Mr. Quinn and the Mr. Satterthwaite sort of pairing. And I think it's quite interesting and worth looking at especially in the context of what she does other places. So that was sort of, you know, there's only the one collection of short stories and a few other stray short stories. So that
I have a theory that Mr. Quinn is a time.
He could be anything. He's a hell of a thing. So that was easily slotted in. You, Deb, are a big fan of Tommy and Tuppence. I was I was kind of prepared to leave Tommy and Tuppence alongside the road. But I'm glad we didn't. And so we went with NRM, which is the sort of middle book of, I guess, their three or four books. Because there's
right.
mm-hmm. By the Pricking of My Thumbs, which is like a late Tommy and Tuppence.
Right. And then Secret there's Partners in Crime. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they, it really, sort of their stories really go from the time they meet until like they're very elderly, which I think is interesting.
They're the only characters in Christie who really age, mm-hmm. which is quite interesting in something resembling real time. And then, you know, you have the Poirot and the Marple. And I actually picked the two that I think not necessarily are the best mysteries or the most famous mysteries. I think if you do that, then you clearly probably go with Murder of Roger Ackroyd or Murder on the Orient Express. It's harder to tell what the definitive Marple is, maybe Body in the Library. But I went with the two that made emotional impacts, which is rare for Christie's novels. Is that two that actually seemed to be plumbing the depths of humanity a bit deeper. They're not just sort of mysteries. They actually seem to have maybe a little bit of something to say about life.
And they also employ slightly different mechanics in the way that the mystery is tackled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and she has an entire phase where she kind of gets very focused on memory and stuff and things like that and kind of recalling past events. And Murder in Retrospect, which is also called Five Little Pigs, depending on the edition, is the best of those, in my opinion. And it's also, it is the purest Poirot can be. He goes, he talks to people, he sits, and he figures it out. That is all that happens.
I thought it was a nice contrast between, and I'm reading the Five Little Pigs edition, between that and Murder's Announced, because they're very similar, and let's go talk to people about what happened. And so it was a nice parallel because it's sort of a similar technique but done completely differently in a different context.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
And of course, the thing with Five Little Pigs, which makes it somewhat different for a murder mystery, is that the murder happened years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's 16 years before the start of the novel, and a woman was convicted and jailed and died in prison. Although it's interesting, in the TV adaptation, I'm 99% sure they had her actually be hanged, it's expressly not done in the novel. They say she wasn't hanged, but I'm pretty sure in the movie version, which is pretty solid and faithful in most respects, although it does twist a few things here and there, they actually do have her be executed. Should we start with that, since that's sort of where we're talking right now already?
Yeah, why not?
So, Deb, I don't know what you thought of any of these, except for I know that Tommy and Tuppence maybe, but we'll talk about that. What did you think?
Well, you know, it's funny because I went through, like I said, I went through a very intense Agatha Christie phase when I was much, much younger. And I think I was probably 18 or 19. And I was working my way through college and had a job in Wilmington, Delaware, which, you know, the city. And there was a little, very tiny little city. There was a little used bookstore around the corner from my office. And I would go in there during my lunch hour and somebody had like cleared out their entire paperback Christie library, and I think the books were a dime. And every couple days I go in and grab another handful. So I sort of immersed myself at that point. And I remember really not liking Poirot as much. He was probably my least favorite of all the ones that I read. But going back and reading this now, you know, many years later as an adult, I think of all the stories that we read, I enjoyed this one the most. I think there's sort of a technical skill in this writing and the way that she approached this story. And I don't know whether I'd feel that way going back and reading all the Poirots, but in this particular, of the four that we selected, I found myself most captivated and appreciating the writing of this story, perhaps more than the Tommy and Tuppence NRM, which I thought that I was going to go back and adore because I just love those two characters and I love their relationship. And I kind of was seeing all the technical difficulties in that book that I probably missed when I was, you know, 18 and 19. And they bothered me much more this time around. But I really enjoyed, I enjoyed the structure of this. I enjoyed sort of the machinations of Poirot and the personalities that he assumed based on each person that he was interviewing. And I particularly, you know, knowing what we know about Agatha Christie and her personal life, you can't help but read into that, how she treated, you know, should we spoil these books? Can we spoil them for people?
I think they were published at the most recently 60 years ago. I think we're going to have to spoil them. Yeah.
All right. So, in Unmasking the Murderer is the person who is trying to steal the husband, of the, of the person who was murdered. You sort of really see it's, and I try not to do that, but I couldn't help projecting her own personal relationship because her husband did leave her for his mistress, and it caused her to sort of have some sort of a breakdown, which is all up for debate as to what actually happened, even though anybody who watched Doctor Who knows that it's all because of a giant wasp. But, she disappeared for a week after this all occurred. So, I couldn't help myself from projecting that a little bit and how she treated this very cold, icy character who was the young girl who was trying to steal the husband of the woman who was convicted of murder. But I found myself slowing down to read this one a little bit more because I liked how it was being played out. And it wasn't as dialogue heavy as some of the other novels that we were reading in this series. So I this one really caught me much more than I thought. I was surprised.
Haha. Point for me.
I think a lot of these type of novels you can you always have those sort of red herrings that get thrown in there to try and throw you off the scent, but I think she's great at giving you just enough where you're swaying between different characters as to I'm absolutely certain now it's got to be this person, and she does a great job of that. I think she's a real populist writer. I don't know if she's necessarily one of the most gifted technical writers, but she understands characters, and she's great at, obviously, in her background she worked with medicines, didn't she? So she knows all about sort of poison.
Yeah, she was in a dispensary in World War One.
So you get this kind of verisimilitude to it, that you get that reality in the way it all plays out. But I find her sort of murder mysteries quite, it's like putting on an old pair of shoes, really sort of comfortable. You can sit down and enjoy it and take it in. Mm-hmm. And the characters, I mean, I know perhaps with the passing of time, certain aspects of life back then aren't quite seen in the same way. I think you can generally regard, having read most of the books, that foreigners aren't to be trusted, for starters. Even if they're completely legit, they're a bad egg.
Yes, foreigners, lower class. It's very classism is sort of rampant throughout.
But. Yeah. What's interesting, though, is she frequently subverts or inverts that. She'll have the really unpleasant characters mistrust foreigners. And she has, through Poirot, in Murder Retrospective and in other books, she has him talk about the fact that that the Englishman thinks that because he looks the way he does and talks the way he does, he clearly must be an idiot. And he plays that up. And so it's sort of like she uses that. And she falls victim to it too. She's a creature of her times, but she's at least somewhat aware of the fact that the English attitude of foreigners, what rot, is seriously flawed and leads to a great many troubles.
Yeah, you see that even more so, I think, in NRM, because the foreigner characters in that one, all turn out to be the good guys or very trustworthy, and it is the very hale and hearty Englishman who turns out to be the spy, the fifth columnist, because you have the German and you have the foreign woman who turned out to actually be Betty's mother. And they're all very, very suspicious characters, and they're all played to type, and they all turn out to be quite innocent. And I thought that was sort of, like you said, it was subverting that trope of you can't trust these, that sort of builds up throughout her writing.
So what did you think revisiting Tommy and Tuppence? Because I find Tommy and Tuppence charming. I find their stories to be kind of bleh. And this was no exception. I thought the storyline of NRM was really, it's like when she had a sort of half-baked spy idea, she would throw Tommy and Tuppence in to make it, worth reading, but that's about it. I don't think she pays the same